Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Folklore. This is one of the many podcast channels that you can find on the New Books Network. I'm Rachel Hopkin, and today my guest is Michael Dylan Foster, who is Professor of Japanese and Department Chair of East Asian Languages and Cultures at UC Davis. He's going to be talking about a new volume which he recently co-edited with Jeffrey Tolbert, who is an Assistant Professor of American Studies and Folklore at Penn State. And the book in question is called The Folkloresque, Reframing Folklore in a Popular Culture World. Michael Dylan Foster, welcome to New Books in Folklore.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I'm going to start off in our traditional way by asking you if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be a folklorist.
Okay, yeah. I am a folklorist primarily focusing on the geographical region of Japan. And I've been a folklorist now for, 20 or 30 years, I think. And my research has focused mostly on Japanese monsters, what we could call folk monsters, something called yokai, sort of like the fairy lore of Japan. I've done a lot of research on that. And I've also done a lot of research on ritual and festival in Japan. So that's been my academic focus, but of course there's been a lot of work affiliated with that I've done as well. I became a folklorist. I was working in Japan. I was teaching English after college in Japan for a few years and learned Japanese to a certain extent. And then I wanted to get a master's degree in Asian studies. So I started to study at UC Berkeley. And I really didn't know what my objective was. I just sort of wanted to explore more about Japanese culture and perhaps go into political science or something like that at some point, work for the State Department, something like that. But I ended up taking some literature courses, and I was taking a pre-modern Japanese literature course. And I had a book that I picked up in Japan while traveling called The Legends of Tono in English. And I showed that to my professor, and I said, you know, I'd like to write my final paper on this book. And he said, well, you can't do that because that book is not about pre-modern Japan. It's about modern Japan. And it's not literature. It's folklore. But if you're interested in folklore, he said, there is a very famous folklorist teaching at this university, a guy named Alan Dundas. So why don't you take one of his classes? So I took his advice, and I took Alan Dundas's classes. And Alan Dundas, of course, was a major fascinating folklorist. And I took his undergraduate lecture class first, and then I took his graduate seminars. And I suddenly realized that for much of my life, I've been interested in folklore. I just didn't know there was a word associated with it. And that's how I got involved.
That's quite a common story, isn't it? Once you know that there is a discipline of folklore, it's like, oh, right, there it is.
Exactly.
I just want to digress a moment because you said you studied with Alan Dundas, who is this huge figure in folklore. And I'm curious to know what he was like as a teacher.
Oh, he was curiously fascinating as a teacher. Right? And so the first course I took with him was an undergraduate class. I think it was kind of a notoriously famous class at UC Berkeley. It was called Anthropology 160. It probably had, 200 or 300 students. And there was something, and I can't quite place it, there's something almost mesmerizing about the way he spoke. He wasn't particularly articulate or eloquent. He didn't have any of the external signs of a great lecturer, but there was something that was just so passionate, enthusiastic, and deeply resonant about the way he spoke. So that I remember this very specifically when I started sitting in on the class he gave us, and this is again a huge lecture class. He gave us a bibliography of important books by folklorists. And for the first several weeks of class, every class he would start with about 10 minutes just going down that list and describing the books. And maybe it was because I had suddenly discovered folklore as a field and I was obsessed with it. But I think it was even more, there was something just so vibrant in it that I looked forward to him describing books. It was a really, you know, it's something that's so rare. But that sort of just listening to him intellectually explore what these books are about and criticize them sometimes and exhort them other times as something we should be reading. It was just really fascinating. So that there was this weird attractiveness to him that kind of in place of, you know, a difficult to describe charisma. And the same in his graduate seminars as well. And the seminars were in some ways quite rigorous, but it was almost a privilege to listen to him talk about things, even when we didn't always agree with him. He was very open to discussion and even conflict. And he liked to be challenged, I think. So he was really a kind of a curious, dynamic, charismatic, brilliant individual.
Speaking of describing books, that's sort of what you're going to do now. So what was the impetus behind this book?
So the folkloresque is a new word or a newish word that my co-author and I wanted to sort of put out there as a kind of heuristic device to sort of unpack a lot of what's going on. It has always been going on, but I think is more evident now, perhaps because of new media and the internet and globalization as well. Unpack what's going on with the relationship between what we call folklore and what we call popular culture. And I want to say right from the bat, right off from the start, that we call it popular culture, but you could substitute the word popular culture here for literature or film or all sorts of other forms of cultural expression. The way that the book came about was, for me, what happened was, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, I was invited to give a talk about a Japanese anime, an animated film by a very, very famous one by Miyazaki Hayao, an animation called Spirited Away. And I think this was back in 2007. I was invited to a university to talk about the folklore in that particular film, the Japanese folklore. And when I started watching the film carefully, looking for folklore, there was something in there that resonated with my understanding of Japanese tradition, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it. It was a very vague sense of connection. And more importantly, what I saw the director doing was creating new conglomerations of what sort of folkloric motifs using words from traditional Japanese folktales and even literature on folklore, but putting them in different contexts and sort of creating something new with pieces that were cobbled together, little bits and pieces from a real tradition, a real tradition meaning from traditional narratives, from traditional belief systems that have been documented. I saw that going on and I didn't know how to describe that. So I, you know, I thought about a lot of the older words that have been used for this kind of thing, folklorism or folklorismus, also the word fakelore, a very sort of pejorative word, but a word that's had some value at a time. And the word that really came to me to describe it most adequately was the word folkloresque. And I can talk more about what that ended up meaning in a little while, but this was something, so this was, I think, 2007, and it was sort of in the back of my head, and I thought at some point when I have more time to focus on this, I'd really like to sort of dig up really get into the whole history of the field of folklore studies and think about how people have dealt with this conundrum, the relationship of folklore and tradition with something that's popularly produced for remuneration, right? To sell as a profitable enterprise. And I thought about this, it was sort of in the back of my head, and I mentioned it at one point. I was teaching at Indiana University at this point, and it was probably the year 2010, 2011, 2012. I'm not sure when. I was teaching a graduate seminar on historical literary methods to folkloristics. And one of my students, Jeff Tolbert, in class, I very briefly mentioned this notion of the folkloresque. I sort of explained what I just explained here. And he got very excited about this when Jeff heard this and came up to me after class. He said, you know, I've been thinking about something similar to this, a little bit different, but some similar elements. And he said to me, and he was just a fairly new PhD student at the time. He said, you should write something about this. And I said, yeah, I'd love to write something about it, but not right now. I'm working on some other projects. Anyway, I got to know Jeff over the years. I was on his dissertation committee. He took a lot of classes with me, and we became friends. And he would always exhort me to write something about this. And one day, I just said, "Well, listen, why don't we write something together?" And then we started bouncing the idea off of other people we knew who might be interested in it, and we came up with the idea of doing an edited volume like this. And so that the genesis was really it was exciting because it's so rare, I think, at least in my experience, to really have the genesis of a book project and hopefully a useful idea for a lot of people to come out of an intellectual exchange in an academic seminar. I really, it's kind of the kind of thing you read about in legend, as it were. So it was really nice that it actually happened and it actually came into fruition and as an object that we can now hold in our hands and share with other people.
That's a very inspiring story. So tell us more about what the folkloresque actually is and how it manifests.
Okay, yeah. So what the folkloresque is, and I guess this also, of course, gets into the notion of what folklore is, which as you know, and all the listeners, I assume, to this podcast will know, is a huge can of worms to open up the definition of what folklore is. And so I won't really do this because part of what the book is about is sort of playing with that idea. But there's I think maybe there's two elements we can think of. One is that when we think of folklore, we often think of expressive culture of some sort that is, and there are certain, I always like to allude to Elliot Oring's old article where he doesn't want to define folklore, but he talks about various orientations. When I teach it, I like to call them the Oring's orientations, that he points out that folklorists in practice tend to do research on expressive culture that fits into these categories, not all of them, but these orientations, these tendencies. And some of those include things like the marginality of the item under discussion, power structures and ideologies involved. But he also talks about the notion of, you know, face-to-face communication, which of course is now very mediated in a lot of ways, but the informality of the transmission of an item of folklore. And the other thing that I think about in terms of that is the fact that folklore in practice often is not for financial profit, for example. And that aspect of the commercialization, the commercial aspect is something that stands in opposition to popular culture. And a popular culture, whether a product, whether it's a comic book, whether it's a film, whether it's an animation, whether it's music, whatever it is often, and I don't want to say 100%, but is often done to make money, and it's done commercially. And you can see that play out in a number of ways. Folklore, I think, like to think of as a kind of an open source, right? Anybody can retell a folktale or a legend or a joke. But you can't do that with Mickey Mouse. You can't draw a picture of Mickey Mouse and sell it without violating copyright laws. So that's one sort of fundamental way in which the law actually makes it distinguishes between these two fields of expression. So that's one dynamic that's going on. One way I like to think of folklore as being different from popular culture in that sense. The other is what we're talking about in with the folkloresque is really popular culture and literary objects that draw on folklore in a particular way, given that sort of distinction that I just tried to set up. And they draw on popular culture, but the idea of the folkloresque is to allow us to think about what it is that consumers of popular culture think of when they think of folklore. So it's kind of a popular culture, popular culture's emic, or the consumers of popular culture, their emic understanding of what folklore is, if that makes any sense.
Right, which is often at odds with what trained folklorists in the academic realm think of as folklore.
Exactly, exactly. And that's really, that was really one of the impetuses for the book, is that, you know, as trained folklorists, we can't ignore what people call folklore, right? That the whole, folklorists have traditionally paid attention to vernacular understandings. So one of the vernacular understandings we should think about is the vernacular understanding of what folklore is. And that's often expressed within popular cultural products, whatever those are.
One of the things you say in the introduction is that you're not using folkloresque as any kind of pejorative term, unlike fake lore, for example, which did have that connotation. It's more this is opening up a new field of study, or naming a field of study.
Yeah, and I want to recognize that, and we do recognize this in the book, that everything we're saying here is, in many ways, it's not new. We're sort of synthesizing a lot of ideas, but as you say, we're naming a field of study, naming an idea, and trying to pull it away from a pejorative boundary-making associations that used to be attached to the study of popular culture as opposed to folklore. We're really not, the distinction, as one of the contributors to the book said, ideally the distinction between the word folkloresque will have a shelf life, that at some point we'll realize that the intertwining of popular culture and folklore, the folkloresque and the folkloric, or whatever we want to call it, is really the boundaries are so blurred that they're no longer important. But at the moment, I think those boundaries aren't that blurred. And it is important to use this as a device to look at the way in which folklore is consumed and produced and sold by entities who may not actually belong to the particular tradition out of which that folklore is emerging, for example. So we wanted to, as you mentioned, make it a non-pejorative expression, a very open-ended label to do what a lot of people have already been doing, looking at literary representations of folklore, looking at there's a whole field of fairy tale film studies, and all of that I think does fit within the notion of the folkloresque. And this is in part, as you mentioned, the word fake lore, which as many listeners will know, was created by Richard Dawson in 1950 as an explicit critique of what he saw as people profiting from reprinting and selling folk tales and other things from specific traditions. And I don't want to be too critical of Dawson, because I think what Dawson was trying to do at that point was set aside some boundaries for what it is that academic folklorists should be doing. He wasn't critical of that material itself, but he was trying to sort of really enhance the field of folklore studies as a specialist field. So that was a very sort of disciplinarily important move at the time. But by labeling something fake lore, it also makes the folklorist the judge of what's real and what's fake, what's authentic and what's not authentic. And what we're trying to do with the folkloresque is get rid of that. What's the authenticity lies with the consumer of the product, and that's what we're really trying to get at. And I would also add, I think if Richard Dawson were alive today, he would be very much into this project. I think he would very much agree with what we're trying to do here. That's just my sense of having read his materials, that he would be open-minded to this.
I think so too. I mean, he was a man of his time.
Exactly.
You say in the introduction that the folklorists and folklore are still a binary, but at least they provide a new mechanism for exploring the structure, unpacking the dynamics of the folklorist, both with regard to its production and its perception, reveals the quality that makes something seem folkloric. So it's a way of working out what it is that's kind of folkish.
Exactly. And to get back to what I actually, I wrote a chapter about in this book, and what sort of the initial impetus to this was that movie Spirited Away. And I don't know if you've seen that, but it's a wonderful movie. It really is. And what's fascinating about that movie to me was that I watched it and I saw all these, all I could think of, they're almost fragments or really what they are, there's identifiable motifs in there. And Michael Coven, a folklore says that he's created a word, motif spotting, as a kind of thing that you can do with popular culture. And his point, and we totally agree with that, is that's just the beginning, right? That's where you start. And then you go from there and try to figure out what's happening with those motifs. And so I started to look at Spirited Away and found all these, what I saw as motifs, some of them directly referencing Japanese cultural traditions, but more importantly, others that were much vaguer in their references. You know, the fact that a lot of the important action in the movie takes place on a bridge, for example, and there's tunnels, and twilight is a very important time in the film. So, you know, these liminal spaces and times are really critical. Now, that's not a particular, that does exist in Japanese folklore, and it exists in many different folklore traditions. And of course, that itself is a motif, right? So what the director was doing was you drawing from existing identifiable things that we feel we may have seen before or felt before or read about before in a folktale or legend or whatever, and putting them together in unique ways to create a product that is not part of a folklore tradition, but feels like it emerged from it.
You say that there's three ways in which the folkloresque kind of appears, or at least there may be more than that, but that's what you're concentrating on in the book. And the book is divided up into sections according to these three ways. So can you just give us a brief outline of the three ways, and then we'll move on to the different sections?
Sure. And that was really important. You know, as you can tell, even from my conversation about this, it's a very large kind of complex set of threads that are intertwined. And we wanted to have a starting point to help try to put some order on these things. And what we came up with are three modes of discourse within the folkloresque. And as you said, there could be many more. These were just the three that sort of emerged from discussions between Jeff and myself and with a lot of our contributors. And when we started talking to them about what they wanted to contribute, it seemed that we could break it up into three general categories. The first one is this one that I was sort of describing just now with Spirited Away, which we called integration. The idea being that it integrates into a new product all sorts of motifs and references. In my own research, article, I call it fuzzy illusions, allusions to things that are existing in other traditions, and brings them together in a way in which we can't necessarily identify where it comes from, but we have a sense, a fuzzy sense, that it does belong to a tradition or several different traditions. So that's what we called integration. The next category is portrayal. And portrayal is a little bit of a sort of a meta-folkloric idea of how folklore as a field, as a discipline, either named or suggested within a popular cultural product or a literary text or film, how that is portrayed. And sometimes that gets to how folklorists themselves as individuals are portrayed. And that has some very interesting, you know, when you start thinking about it, you see that also very clearly reflects the vernacular idea in a given culture of what a folklorist is and what folklore as a field is. So that's the second form. And the third form is a really quite complicated, I think, but actually really fascinating. And we called that, for lack of a better word, we called it parody. And in that case, We could have also called it as well something like meta-folklore or meta-commentary or something. And that's when you get a cultural product that giving homage to an existing something within folklore, giving homage to it at the same time, playing with that idea. And the consumer, the viewer of the film or the reader of the text, is very much aware that that's going on. The parodic aspect of it is catalyzed by the fact that the consumer is cognizant of the critique that's occurring. And one very, to me, a wonderful example of that is a lot of the, actually even some recent Disney films, but films like Enchanted, which are playing not only with the viewer's understanding of sort of traditional European folktales, but also playing with the viewer's understanding of the way those folktales have been Disneyfied or used in popular culture. So there's a multi-leveled critique and sort of meta-commentary going on. So that's a very complicated way in which the folkloresque is used, but that one we also thought was quite valid and interesting.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right, well, let's move on to the first section. And your essay is the first one in that section, which is the section on integration. And you've talked a little bit about it already, but tell us more about it. It's called The Folkloresque Circle, Toward a Theory of Fuzzy Illusion.
Yeah, so as I was saying, I was trying to figure out with Spirited Away how illusion was working in that case. And my conclusion was that in most cases, the illusions themselves were fuzzy. You would see a bridge, and it wasn't, and there'd be a folklore connection to that bridge, but it wasn't connection to a specific identifiable folktale in Japanese tradition, for example. And I play in this article, in this chapter, I set that in opposition to another film, actually by a different director, but the same studio, a film called Pompoko, which very few people have watched, but in the US, very few people have watched it. But that film has as characters a little something called a raccoon dog or a tanuki, which is a folkloric character in Japan that's very, very well known for its shape-shifting and its antics, and it's a mischievous supernatural creature, a real animal, but it also has supernatural characteristics. And in the film, Pompoko, those characteristics are very, very clearly demonstrated, and there are what I call precise illusions pointing directly to existing known folktales, for example, one in particular about called the Lucky Teapot. There's all kinds of comic allusions to that. So if you're watching this with no background knowledge of specifically Japanese folklore, you wouldn't understand it. It would just be a weird movie.
Yes, I think one of the characteristics of this creature is its gargantuan testicles that perform many of the transformations.
Yes, exactly. And this is something, and this is on my mind now because I just actually finished teaching a course here at UC Davis in which as an experiment, it's the first time I've done this, but I showed them Spirited Away, and then I also showed them this movie Pompoko, and we discussed the folkloresque, and we tried to look at this. And a lot of them, and these are students who are really into Japanese culture, which is why they took the course. but very few of them had ever seen Pompoko. And as you point out, one of the distinguishing characteristics of the tanuki is its gigantic testicles and the fact that it can expand its scrotum to be several square meters in size and do all kinds of magical stuff with that magical apparatus, as it were. And of course, this looks crazy if you don't know it. But my students, I prepared them for that. And afterwards, some of them made comments that, yeah, had I not known that's what was going on, that would have been utterly strange and somewhat, well, it is disgusting anyway, the way it's portrayed, but utterly strange film that I wouldn't have understood. So that's one aspect, that's what I would call a precise illusion. So the Japanese viewer would have some kind of background knowledge of that to generalize. And other things, even more specific, there's actually specific references to paintings and imagery that if you grew up in Japan, you would probably be exposed to. Whereas the average viewer from outside that culture wouldn't have that sense of connection. Spirited Away, on the other hand, one reason it was actually internationally popular, I think it won the Academy Award for Best Animated Film or Best Foreign Animated Film, I'm not sure what the category was, but was one of the reasons it was critically successful and popularly successful around the world, and my students all have seen it, was because it didn't make those precise illusions. You don't have to have that specific learned acquaintanceship with the culture in question to understand it. Whereas with Pompoko, you do. And Pompoko, I looked up a bunch of reviews of it. First of all, it didn't play very well in the US. And then when it was reviewed in the US, even in the New Yorker, I think, which is usually a fairly sophisticated venue, their comment was, this is, something about how even for Japan, this is a completely bizarre movie. So the cross-cultural aspect doesn't work unless you're familiar with the illusions. And again, this is where there's a distinction between the fuzzy illusion, a vague allusion to folkloric things, whatever those are, and precise allusion to actual identifiable references. So that was the sort of opposition that I tried to discuss in the article. In the end, though, and this is the reason it's called the folklorist circle, is as we were saying, you know, these are two different things: the folklore and the folkloresque. But if we really start tracing them historically, we can see, I like to think of it as a kind of Mobius strip, that they seem like they're two sides of something, but they really are deeply connected. It's really a circle. So even, for example, and I'm just sort of speculating, but the film Spirited Away has become such a sort of mainstay of Japanese culture for kids that I suspect many children who watch that think that some of the gods and demon figures in that film are real gods and demon figures from Japanese folklore and folk belief. So, in 40 years, they may have entered tradition in a more sort of folkloric way. So there is this kind of interplay between these things that's unquestionable. So I like to think of it more as not that they're separate, but they're really, you know, Mobius strip. Like if you really trace one side, you find yourself on the other side.
One feeds into the other and back again.
Exactly.
There are three other essays in this section on integration. Are you able to give us a brief idea of what's in those?
Yeah, just very briefly. The second one is the work is by Timothy Evans, a wonderful folklorist in Kentucky. And his research is on the text of Neil Gaiman, who probably many of your listeners are aware of, kind of the fantasy writer and very dynamic, also a graphic novelist. But and actually, I'm trying to remember which book he's actually focusing on here. But what Tim does in this essay is he looks at the way in which Neil Gaiman very consciously incorporates folkloric elements into his work. He integrates them in ways that give a sense of authority to what's going on. And then he takes it from there. And I'm not doing it justice because I haven't read the article recently. But that's what he's doing in there. He's working with Neil Gaiman. Paul Manning has written an article, a chapter called Pixie's Progress, How the Pixie Became Part of the 19th Century Fairy Mythology, which, as the title looks at, and Paul Manning is a linguistic anthropologist up in Canada. And he studies how the pixie as a fairy-like creature was very, I don't want to say consciously, but in some ways deliberately introduced into a broader fairy mythology in 19th century Britain through the works of one particular author who at the same time was creating a nostalgic sense of the countryside where she was living. So we look at the way in which, again, integrate folkloric elements from existing traditions were integrated into her notion of the pixie. And then those were reintroduced, as it were, into people's ideas of fairy lore in that area.
Yes, I was actually very surprised to learn that pixies were located in Dartmoor. I didn't realize they had a locality in the same way that leprechauns are associated with Ireland. I thought the pixies were, you know, everywhere. That's how I was raised thinking of pixies.
Well, and I think that's really sort of the point. That's how it works with this, the way it becomes the folkloresque, the whatever we want to call it, the literary, the popular cultural version of folklore actually becomes the folklore of the next generation, as it were. So you grew up with this generalized idea that was probably in part created by the works that Paul Manning is discussing here.
Right. And then there's one more, Comics as Folklore by Daniel Peretti.
Yeah, so that also looks at a very similar idea that he discusses particularly comics, Superman comics. And he looks at actually both directions. So he looks at the way in which the Superman comic, as it was constructed, did this integration that we're talking about, sort of drawing from existing traditions and creating Superman out of that. But then how Superman as a character has also entered into a more vernacular discourse now, where there's Superman festivals and people will make their own costumes. And Superman, in that sense, has sort of been created through bits and pieces of folklore tradition into a commercial product, which then has entered back into a vernacular circulation.
So that's the section on integration. Then we come to portrayal. Tell us a little bit more about what's in this section.
Right. And portrayal, again, was the notion of the way in which folklore itself as a discipline, those items considered folklore, fairy tales, whatever people call folklore, and folklorists are portrayed within popular cultural products. So the good example of that is the first one that by my co-author, Jeff Tolbert, in which he looks at the video game, Fatal Frame, and the way in which folklorists in that particular game are sort of the repositories of arcane and occult knowledge, and they're asked to help out with certain situations because of that special knowledge that they have. So it's a very particular vernacular understanding of what a folklorist is, and I do wish we had special knowledge, but the next one is and you can see these different, we're really all over the place in terms of genre, and that's part of the point of this. And the next one is to look at Eamon Kelly, who is a 20th century Irish storyteller. And in this, Chad Buterbaugh does a great sort of explanation of the way in which Eamon Kelly created himself as a traditional storyteller. He was Irish, but he was also very intentional in the aesthetics that he developed for his presentation. So he was performing the idea of a traditional storyteller within Ireland and became a folk hero in a sense in that context. Then the final chapter in there is New Minted from the Brothers Grimm, Folklore's Purpose and the Folkloresque in the Tales of Beetle the Bard. This is by Jeff Tolbert and also by Carly Holt Jensen. They wrote this together. And that one looks at how folktales are actually treated within, but folktales as a genre, and so not necessarily real folktales or real from tradition, but folktales as a genre are created and treated within the Harry Potter series. So again, the portrayal of what a folktale is, or I think in this case, they're actually fairy tales. So that's the second section.
One of the things that's mentioned is that since this is the vernacular view of what folklore is and what folklorists do, sometimes these folkloresque portrayals bring people to the discipline.
Yes. And that's a very important aspect of why we really think it's important not to be pejorative towards these folkloresque portrayals, because it's so many of us, and I know this from teaching at Indiana University for 8 years, a lot of the students, even entering the graduate program, would enter with an idea of what folklore is that was not our idea as scholars of folklore, but it was that thing that attracted them to the discipline. And they entered, and then when we started explaining how the discipline had developed and what its particular focuses in the plural had been over the last, 100, 150 years, those students were sometimes disillusioned, frankly, but often they also started to see what they were doing in a different light as well. But certainly, yeah, it's these popular culture versions of folklore that really attract people to think about it more deeply. And so what we're trying to do with the folkloresque is say, why don't we look at those popular culture versions as well as folklorists, but as also people who want to understand, what's happening within culture. So, I think you're absolutely right. And that's one hope with this book too, is that people who are studying popular culture will read it and see connections that they didn't realize might exist.
The last section is on parody, which you described as the most complex version of the folkloresque.
Right, yeah. And this is, when we think of parody, we often think of humor or satire or something funny. And in this case, some of these are that way. But again, parody not only... meta commentary, but in this case, parody is using the format, using the aesthetics of a particular genre to critique, at the same time pay homage to that particular genre. One of the essays by Trevor Blank focuses on jokes that were told at the Penn State, in response to the Penn State sexual abuse scandal, which was a terrible scandal in which, and I'm not an expert on this at all, but football players at Penn State University in Pennsylvania were abused by one of the coaches for many, many years. And he was finally caught and arrested and is in prison now. And this all came out, I believe, probably around 20, the dates are in here, but 2012, 2013 or something. And what Trevor Blank did was he collected jokes that were being told on campus. He was on campus at the time concerning that event. And what he's really focusing on here, though, is the way in which jokes are taken for this very specific event, but they're often repurposed from other events. And people would hear the joke and know that it was also referring to a previous joke. So it's a kind of complicated parody of a joke within the joke. At the same time, it's also commenting on a very specific and really horrific situation that people were experiencing. The next chapter, The Jokes on Us, An Analysis of Meta-Humor, is by Greg Kelly, who's also a jokester, but also a joke expert. And this is one of the things that he's doing here is talking about how jokes, what he calls meta jokes, jokes that reference other jokes for their humor. And actually, I just opened to a page and there's a great short example of this. He says, a priest, a rabbi, and a minister walk into a bar. The bartender looks up and says, "Hey, what is this? Some kind of joke?" So of course, the humor is based on the fact that we know that so many jokes start with a priest, a rabbi, and a minister walking into a bar.
Actually, there's quite a lot of funny jokes in that chapter.
Yeah, this one in particular is a good, it's a good laugh, as it were. And we can see what's going on there with, this is a parody of jokes in themselves. So it's commenting on that form of folklore. And in so doing, it's actually paying homage to it and also critiquing it. So that's what he's doing there. And I do recommend that for some brilliant analysis, but also for some good jokes. Penultimate chapter is the Fairy Telling Craft of Princess Tutu, Meta-Commentary and the Folkloresque by Bill Ellis. And this is also a rather complicated one. He's talking about an anime called Princess Tutu, a Japanese anime. But in the anime, it's a little too complicated to briefly summarize. But what is happening is that the characters of a particular sort of fairy tale tradition are taking over their own narrative. And so it's a commentary at the same time on the fairy tale, but also deeply embedded into a commentary on the fairy tale, tale type, as it were, various tale types and motifs, but at the same time, deeply embedded with a critique of storytelling itself and an homage to the whole process. And so he very, I think, creatively calls it fairy telling. So not fairy tale, but fairy telling, because it's a craft that's being practiced by the actual characters of the tale itself. As you can tell, the parody section is a little is very complex. So I encourage readers to look at that carefully.
Briefly, can you just tell us about the final chapter?
The final chapter is by Greg Schremp, and it's called Science and the Monsterological Imagination, Folkloristic Musings on David Toomey's Weird Life, the title of the book, Weird Life. And what he's doing here, and again, it's rather complex, but it's kind of a brilliant analysis of the way in which scientists who traditionally have rejected traditional folkloric pantheons of monsters and demons and this sort of monsterological taxonomy, the same scientists who are rejecting that in creating scientific books, and this, I think, David Toomey's book is about it's a analysis of strange life formations, you know, but it's a very scientific analysis. But in even as they're rejecting these older, quote, folkloristic conceptions of the universe, they're replicating them in what they're doing. Their own pantheon of weird life, as it were, as that they're creating to refute the older ideas, is actually very much in the same, has the same shape and reflects those very things that they're critiquing. What's interesting in particular about this, I think, is that the parody that's occurring here is not necessarily understood by the authors themselves, that a sophisticated reader like Greg Schremp, who's an expert in these fields, a sophisticated reader can do that analysis and see that the book itself is, without the author's knowledge necessarily, the book itself is parodying those very forms that it's replicating and critiquing.
Well,
at the
that
same
was
time.
A very quick rattle through the whole book. Is there anything that you want to say about it that I haven't given you the opportunity to?
Simply that I didn't do any of those chapter descriptions justice, and I probably got some things wrong. I haven't read it since for several years since it came out in 2016. But I would ask readers to look at those and think about them. And I think the important part of this book is our hope. The book is not at all conclusive. The book is not the be-all and end-all of this idea. It's really what we're trying to do is just sort of set up this notion of the folkloresque and hand it over to other people to sort of play with and take it in new directions, critique what we've written or add to what we've said or do something with it. And the whole objective really is to make popular culture part of the study of what folklorists have traditionally studied, and also ideally, and I don't know how successful we've been at this, but ideally have students of popular culture and media studies recognize the role that folklore plays in the the text that they're studying as well.
I want to mention to listeners as well that if they go to the publisher webpage for this book, they can download the first chapter, which is your introduction.
Oh, great. I didn't know that.
So, Michael, what are you working on now?
So now I'm actually working on something completely different. I'm working on a project that's been ongoing for me actually for 20 years now. I've been doing research on a particular ritual in Japan that takes place over New Year's Eve, in which demon figures go from, in one small community, demon figures go from house to house scaring children. And it's something I've been really interested in for many years, and I've attended the ritual numerous times, and I'm now finally trying to set it all down into
a
monograph.
I think I've read an article of yours on that, something about it being nominated to UNESCO.
Yeah. So just to make life even more common, there are actually two rituals that I've been working with, and one, and now they're both actually part of UNESCO, the intangible cultural heritage, the representative list of the intangible cultural heritage of humanity. They're both actually on that list now, just by chance, which, while I've been doing this, has given me an opportunity to learn a lot about UNESCO. So I have written some articles on that. That was not the intention when I started, but it became an inevitable side effect of having studied this for so long.
So Michael Dylan Foster, I should let you go now so that you can go and work on that instead of talking to me. But I wanted to thank you very much for taking part in this New Books in Folklore podcast and talking about the folkloresque, reframing folklore in a popular culture world, which you edited with Jeffrey Tolbert. And I also want to remind listeners that the New Books in Folklore podcast is one of many on the New Books Network. So, Michael, have a lovely rest of the day, and thank you.
Thank you very much, Rachel. It's been a pleasure.